Welcome back to Clinician's Brief Partner Podcast. I'm your host, Beth Mollison, a small animal veterinarian and veterinary officer here at Clinician's Brief. Today, I'm thrilled to have Dr. Tracy Dice with us. She is the medical lead for the core therapeutics team with Zoetis, and she is always a delight to talk to. And today, we're here to have a discussion about how we make recommendations to our pet owners, and more specifically, kind of how we approach those conversations around cost and how cost factors into our recommendations. I also want to give a big thank you to Zoetis for making this conversation possible. And of course, Tracy, thank you so much for being here again. Do you mind to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Not at all. It's always great to be with you guys. So I received my DVM from Texas A&M CVM in 1998. You know, I got to put a little whoop in there. I practiced as an ER vet for 15 years in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and then returned to my hometown of Rosenberg, Texas, where I joined a large small animal practice. My special interests include soft tissue surgery, pain management, and ultrasonography. I had the opportunity to serve the vet industry in a little different capacity when I joined Zoetis in 2018. And like you, Beth, I still enjoy practicing, which I do on the weekends. Most importantly, though, I share my life with an adult kiddo, a Doberman named Safira, a Schnauzer named Miss Ives, and an extremely naughty Borzoi named Jesse. Needless to say, there is seldom a dull moment in the Dice family circus.
I was going to say, Tracy, that's a full house. And I enjoyed getting to see a few of those members when you had your camera on a minute ago. So again, thank you for being here. And I do want to talk about this conversation that we keep referencing. And so recently a survey was done trying to collect more information about the factors that go into veterinarians' recommendations and the factors that go on the opposite side into the pet owner decision-making when presented with a treatment plan. And at the crux of this conversation, as we can all kind of imagine, is often cost and how that factors into all of our decisions. So before we get into kind of what we can learn from these results, Tracy, let's talk about the reasons kind of even behind wanting to do this study.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So being in a service industry, especially one that has changed so much in the past several years, it's important to take a pulse on what drives our diagnostic and prescribing habits or recommendations to ensure they align with those of pet owners so that we avoid assumption biases when making recommendations. With state of the industry, and let's be honest, Beth, state of the world in general, we want to be budget conscious and sensitive, and at the same time, avoid making cost-based recommendations before hearing from our clients. And we have to remember that when it comes to cost and value, those are beasts of a different nature.
And I like your use of that term assumption bias, because I think that's something we can all relate to. I think we kind of go about our day, for better or worse, sometimes making those assumption biases. So you recommend that when it comes to having these conversations with pet owners, something that you've termed the pause approach. So I want to get into more about what that entails, if you don't mind to explain that to us.
Yeah, but before we jump into the pause approach, may I pause to share a little backstory and a moment of transparency?
Of course. This is a safe space, Tracy, so please share.
Right. So the pause approach was born out of my realizing that during those, you know, those really wicked busy, chaotic practice days, I tended to reduce treatment plan options and knee-jerk back to antiquated prescribing habits where I would base my treatment plans based on my perceived path of least resistance rather than present the plan that I had the most confidence in and the one that I would use for my own pets. Mm-hmm. Time restrictions and cost biases play a big role in this. So to overcome this habit and ensure continuity in what I was offering all of my pet owners and patients, the core brands team at Zoetis came up with a pause approach to better customize treatment plans for each patient and pet owner. So it's easy and it works in a time crunch. So, okay, now let's unpack the pause. So P, pillability, A, adherence, and W, once treatment now. So the P stands for pillability, and it reminds us to ask our pet owners about the ease in oral medication administration. Is it easy? Is it difficult? Is oral medication administration disruptive to their human-animal bond? Are they experiencing caregiver burden with the presenting pet or any others in the household? All of these are important concepts when selecting systemic therapy modalities. So next is the A, adherence. Adherence has to do with setting our patients and their people up for success when it comes to compliance with treatment plans. And we have to be a safe space, a judgment-free space for these conversations. I use myself as an example when broaching the A with pet owners. See, I love my fur family with all my heart, and yet I am painfully non-compliant. Painfully. So when I let them know that compliance or adherence is not proportional to love, it opens the door for more honest conversations. And adherence is especially important in time-dependent treatment options because treatment success or failure is impacted by missed dosages. And that brings us to the W in the PAW acronym. Once treatment, now. This has to do with how quickly our pet owners want to see results. Is it hours? Is it days? Is it weeks? Because not knowing their expectation could set us up for a perceived treatment failure. So when it comes to prescribing, we want to pause to PAW to ensure that we cover three aspects in treatment conversations before just jumping in with cost.
Yes. And I love that, Tracy. There were a few things that hit home to me. I know, like, even 11 years into practice, I can't tell you how many times I am still guilty of just handing over a pill bottle without ever having a conversation about, you know, is this feasible? What's your schedule like? What's your pet's behavior like? Is this, you know, is this a possibility for you? And I think you bring up a good point in making sure that is something that's discussed. And then I love your adherence is not proportional to love, because same, like, you prescribe a medication, you think, of course they're giving it twice a day. And then when your pet is the one under treatment, all of a sudden you realize that after 10 days, you've got like 4 pills left in the bottle. So anyway, all good call outs, and the PAWS acronym certainly helps us stop to think twice about all those things. So as you mentioned, you know, this is really more about tailoring our recommendations to the individual patient, pet owner, and then, of course, diagnosis. So I want to talk about these survey results and a little bit about what they showed, maybe what some surprises were, and, of course, what our takeaways should be as vets from this poll.
Yeah, great. So let's jump in. The first market research we did, it is the ZMR Harris poll, and it looked at willingness to pay. So looking at prescribing habits based on patient weight. Now, this survey was about dogs. We don't have too many 50-pound cats out there. So it seems that weight-based treatment option seems to be less of a sticky situation for our feline patients. So this was about dogs. And what we looked at is prescribing habits, the number of treatments offered, and what matters most when it comes to offering and accepting treatment options. We looked at it from the vet health team and pet owner perspectives, respectively. So how about I share the results and we can weigh in each on what surprise does and our learning takeaways?
Yes, that sounds great.
Okay. So first we looked at prescribing habits based on patient weight. The two weight categories were dogs weighing less than 50 pounds and those weighing over 50 pounds. So for my metric folks out there, that's probably what, 22.7-ish kilograms, I think. Mm-hmm. So what we learned is that prescribing oral meds and topical meds were, for the two weight brackets, were pretty much the same. But when it came to injectables, 41% of patients under 50 pounds were offered an injectable option, where 28% of the bigs received an injectable option. Drilling down a little further, injectable options were first recommendations 27% of the times in dogs under 50 pounds, but only 18% of the time in dogs over 50 pounds. It's quite a big difference between the bigs versus the littles when it comes to offerings.
Yeah, absolutely, Tracy. And I don't, as far as that statistic goes, I don't know. That doesn't really surprise me because I think we're all guilty, like you mentioned earlier. At least for me, the assumption bias is my hypothesis for what's coming into play there. So that makes sense to me. How many dogs was it that were in this study?
Yeah, great question. It was 420 in this group. So it's a pretty decent sample size.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a pretty big study. But yeah, no surprises there, at least to me.
So, okay, next, let's look at the number of treatment options. You know, we talk about this a lot, Beth. We talk about, like, do we offer the buffet? Do we offer just a few?
Sure.
Because we don't want to overwhelm, but we also want to make sure that we present with enough options to our pet owners. So in this study, 50% of dog owners, so we're looking at the dog owners now, 50% of dog owners reported that their vet health teams offered only one option for medication type, 48% offered multiple options, and the remaining 2% didn't present any treatment options or prescribe any medication. And topicals were included in there.
Okay, interesting. And yeah, that's funny to reflect on, because don't you feel like sometimes you're told, like, oh, you should always just recommend the top level of, you know, the ideal recommendation. And then, of course, there's different thoughts where you don't want to, you know, exclude someone from getting the treatment they need by if your first presentation is maybe not affordable or not a good option. So that's interesting to statistic on seeing what vets are doing out there as far as offering options.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It seems like it's a delicate balance, right?
Between exactly.
Not overwhelming, not assuming, and then making sure the pet owners feel included and have a weigh in on the decision. It's a balancing act. So next, to me, this is one of the most fascinating aspects. We looked at biggest factors in type of medication chosen, and this is going to drill down. This is going to be to treat their dog's bacterial skin infections. And we did this, we asked pet owners, but then we also asked DVMs. So I like this because we're going to get to see both sides of the coin. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when we surveyed pet owners, number one, the vet's recommendation. The top influencer for selection of treatment by 47% of pet owners is what their vets recommend. Next up is what's going to be best for my dog. That's 28%. And then best option for lifestyle was 14%. Weighing in with only 5% was the least expensive option. Now, when we drill down further on medication attributes in a different part of the study, of course, safety, efficacy, ease of administration were the big three for pet owners. And then we looked at cost in our bigs versus our smalls. And cost was more of a concern in dog owners who had dogs less than 50 pounds. That was 7%. Mm-hmm. Compared to those that have dogs over 50 pounds, only 1%.
Interesting. What do you think? Do you have any hypotheses for what explains that difference? Because I would have, you know, potentially expected maybe the opposite, where you have the larger dog owners that are more cost conscious due to pet size.
Yeah. So I thought about this because, and we're going to cover this a little bit more in a case later on in the podcast, but I think dog owners of the bigs. I think many of those pet owners, they've had these breeds. They have experience with these breeds. They expect the cost of treatment maybe to be a little more robust because of their dog's weight. So I think if I had to make an educated guess, and it's not backed by evidence, but if I had to make an educated guess, I think it's just those pet owners, they're familiar with the breed. They've had the breed before. And so they budget and expect a higher cost.
Right. Maybe not their first rodeo with maybe larger vet bills. That makes sense. And I do like, you know, it always feels good to think that at least in theory on these survey results that our pet owners are putting that our recommendation is their top influence. So that's kind of nice to hear.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I bet this can change. For us, it might be surprising. Maybe not, though. I mean, you've practiced for over a decade. I've practiced for a couple of decades now. And, you know, we find that confidence comes with these recommendations. We have certain pet owners who we've been seeing this entire time, and we can walk in and make a recommendation, and we know we're gonna get buy-in because we just have that relationship. But it might not always be so easy for our colleagues who are new to practice. So now that we've seen what is important from the lens of our pet owners, let's talk about biggest factors and types of medications prescribed by vets. Now, this is a different study. This is ZMR Kinetic Brand Equity Scorecard, and it just drills down to anti-infectives used in the vet health team, the vet community. So when we asked veterinarians what is most important when it comes to prescribing habits, this is what was reported. First-time treatment success, speed of onset, safety efficacy, formulation, and ease of administration. So, okay, looking at those two lists and comparing, what we find is cost doesn't land in the top three for pet owners, and it doesn't land in the top three for us.
That is fascinating. And I do feel like, you know, these are interesting results, especially the safety and efficacy, you know, falling maybe a little bit lower down on the list. I know when I think through my own thought process, that's kind of something that's maybe always in the back of your mind, or maybe you're not even considering medications that you don't consider safe and efficacious. And I do, it doesn't surprise me too much that speed of onset and first time treatment success are at the top of the list. Because when I think of factors that are going to, of course, improve patient health and welfare and improve client satisfaction, those two are top on the list. And yeah, it's kind of reassuring that maybe we aren't as driven by cost as sometimes it seems.
Yep, you bet. And I think it's important, you know, we talk that, you know, safety and efficacy, yeah, they're on the list, maybe they're a little bit lower down. And I think it's because we've gotten so comfortable in using certain products.
Exactly.
Sometimes we maybe don't have that, you know, 30-second elevator pitch to cover those aspects of a medication with our pet owners. So maybe this is a good PSA to just say, hey, remember, we do need to include any risk benefit. We need to include a little blip about safety, efficacy, just to keep our pet owners aware and in the loop.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that's something that's easy to get complacent about is addressing some of those concerns. But and I liked this study too, Tracy, because I think it's kind of hitting on that big example of skin disease when we talk about these different treatment options. I know when I'm thinking of multiple different options or multiple treatment plans that I can present to a client, skin disease is kind of that classic example. Mm-hmm. And I do want to take this opportunity to talk a little bit more about Convenia, because that's kind of the first example that comes to my mind when we're talking about maybe injectables that may not be as low cost as some of the other options. And they really can be an amazing tool. And they negate the issue, which is one of my passion points, about antibiotic stewardship and, of course, compliance. So do you mind if we talk through a little bit about the best practices when it comes to antibiotics for these dermatologic cases and how we should be using Convenia in these situations and having those conversations with our pet owners?
No, I don't mind at all. And I have to tell you, you are speaking my love language by saying antibiotic stewardship. So yes, of course. I think whether we're talking about Convenia or really any anti-infective, the gold standard is being good stewards of antimicrobial usage. We want to first diagnose our patients with bacterial skin infections and have culture and sensitivity testing as frequent as possible. We want to establish any underlying causes that might impair resolution, right? Let's see, we want to evaluate histories of antibiotic usage, and we want to select an antibiotic from an appropriate tier that makes sense for the bacteria that we're targeting. And we want to reassess and recheck to make sure we're making progress with infection resolution. Now, most of the antimicrobials we use for bacterial skin infection, or I should say we should be using for bacterial skin infections, are time-dependent antibiotic. That just means they maximize bacterial killing. So they're bacterial assassins by maintaining a time above a drug concentration, above a set MIC. Now, an MIC is just the minimum inhibitory concentration. So it's the lowest concentration of that antibiotic required to inhibit growth of the target organism in a petri dish. So for oral meds, every time we miss or delay a dose, we actually can wax and wane above or below that targeted MIC, which sets us up for treatment failure. Boy, I sure hope I did my the professor that taught me pharmacology. I sure hope that I made her proud now. So with Convenia, we can stay above that MIC for a set number of days. And of course, that's depending on which organism we're targeting. And it's the beauty of it.
Yeah. And that's, you know, you mentioned not only treatment failure, but of course, it avoids that antibiotic or antibiotic resistance that we are so worried about. And when we are using Convenia, do you recommend like a recheck 2 weeks later to evaluate the pyoderma? Or how do we make sure we don't run into any issues if we are using this to treat pyoderma in our practice?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Now I'm taking off my Zoetis hat for a little bit here. I'm not a dermatologist. I know we have some wonderful guidelines that provide direction to this question. ISCAID has a wonderful set of guidelines, but I'm a little nervous to wait a full 14 days. I typically do a progress check. It might be via email. It might just be with a phone call at day seven. I might have owner send me a photo. Now this is going to change whether I'm using Convenia as empirical treatment or if I have culture and sensitivity. Does my patient have a secondary underlying problem that might be a little hurdle? I really want to start seeing a reduction in those lesions. I want to see a 50% reduction at a certain time. Again, that time might be 7 days. It might be 10 days, might be 14 days. It all just depends on the patient and what we're dealing with. And then I'm going to get that patient back in at 14 days. And I'm going to not only do a comprehensive physical exam and check the skin, I'm going to recheck skin cytologies, do another tape prep. I just want to make sure under the microscope, things are tending towards resolution. And I think it's important too. So we recheck at 14 days, everything looks great. Say we're managing a secondary condition. We have to stay in touch with our pet owners to one, make sure the infection's truly resolved, or two, we don't have a reemergence. So I know that answer was all over the place, Beth, all over the place, but you know, it's hard to make a cookie cutter approach. We want to have a tailored approach, but we also want to make it easy for our vet health teams. And that's just what I do. What do you do?
No, that was perfect, Tracy, because that's really just what I want to call attention to is I feel like with these injectables, you know, one of the concerns, at least to me, is that feeling like we give an injection and then say goodbye to our patients. And of course, that's the same concern that we can run into with oral medications, whatever the case may be. So just kind of like to bring up that, you know, recheck and making sure that we're not letting these pyodermas get worse despite treatment and being judicious about our treatment of these infections. So all good advice there. And I do want to talk through this kind of in context of those survey results that, of course, we were discussing. And I hate to say it, Tracy, but even after everything we've talked about, I feel like it's still intimidating to walk into that exam room with the St. Bernard and recommend something that you're worried is going to be too expensive for the pet owner. So do you have any advice for our audience as far as navigating kind of that hurdle?
Yeah, you're not alone. I mean, I think we all experience a little shudder when we have to do that. I know I'm guilty of it. The case that turned this around for me, if I might share.
Absolutely.
It's a sweet, great Dane patient named Sugar Bear. So Sugar Bear and Tank, two Great Danes, brother and sister, they were frequent visitors to Rose Ridge Vet Clinic where I practiced prior to coming to Zoetis full time, and their owner was an absolute dream. As a lover and an owner of giant breed, she expected and budgeted for higher vet costs, although we tried our best to work within a certain budget. On one occasion, we diagnosed Sugar Bear with pyoderma that warranted systemic treatment. And after reading the culture and sensitivity results, I approached Sugar's mom with two options, and both of those options were oral. My heart sank to my belly button when she asked about and selected Convenia. It turns out Sugar Bear turned into Sour Bear upon oral medication administration, and it really impacted their human-animal bond. I can hear her mom relaying the story. It was quite emotional, and I felt like a complete heel because I love Convenia. I choose it for my own pets when it's appropriate, and yet I didn't offer it to Sugar Bear because she weighed 169 pounds. Now she's my muse to prevent myself from that prescribing bias. And I have to tell you, she was a pretty darn cute muse.
Well, I love the name alone, Sugar Bear. Hard to beat that. No, that's a great example, Tracy. I know we've all been in that situation where kind of we make those assumption biases and then the pet owner proves us wrong and it always makes us feel a little stupid. But no, she's a great example to keep in mind when we are trying to kind of just lay out all of the options for our pet owners without any bias. So much good information you've offered for us, Tracy. And good news, we've made it to the lightning round portion of the podcast. No pressure.
This is one of my favorite, and I can't wait to see what you're going to have for me today.
Well, yes, these are just for fun. No pressure. First question for you. Are you pro? It was very controversial. Are you pro or anti pets in costume?
Oh, I'm totes pro, but I live with this. You won't wear them anymore. I totally know that wear outfits is puppies, and I may or may not have some matching outfits.
Oh, matching. That's a step I've never taken it to, but I'm pro. So right answer in my book. And I've had greyhounds before. It's hard. They don't really make a lot of large breed costumes. So that's tough. I feel like they're all tailored toward the small animals.
It's true. See, another, it's a bias.
Yeah, exactly. Very biased. All right, next question, kind of related. Would you rather own a Chihuahua or a Great Dane?
So I'm an equal opportunity lover of bigs and smalls. I've owned a Chihuahua, same with Chico, lived to be 23. So I think I'm both.
That I didn't know that, Tracy. 23. That is very impressive. Yeah. But I like that answer. I'm both as well. I've been a dachshund and greyhound owner, so I'm right there with you. All right, last one for you. This is more of a medical one. Would you rather tackle a 70-pound dog spay or a newly diagnosed diabetic patient?
Ooh, that's a tough one. So when I first left emergency medicine, I would have picked the diabetic because I was quicker at GDVs than big dog spays. But now I'm pretty quick, so I'll take the spay because it's instant gratification.
I like that. Fewer client phone conversations maybe might be the tiebreaker there. Well, Tracy, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for shedding all the light on that conversation that we don't often think too much about. I know that was very informative. Of course, a huge thank you to Zoetis for making this conversation possible. And thank you to our audience for being here today. We will catch you next episode. Important safety information for Convenia. People with known hypersensitivity to penicillin or other cephalosporins should avoid exposure to Convenia. Do not use in animals with a history of allergic reactions to penicillins or cephalosporins. Side effects for both dogs and cats include vomiting, diarrhea, decreased appetite or anorexia, and lethargy. For full prescribing information, visit conveniapi.com, C-O-N-V-E-N-I-A-P-I.com.